From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. We're learning more about the suspect police have detained after shootings at spas in the Atlanta area. Six of the eight people killed were Asian. Captain Jay Baker of the Cherokee County Police addressed the question of the suspected shooter's motives today.
The suspect did take responsibility for the shootings. He does claim that it was not racially motivated.
WABE's Lisa Hagan joins us from Atlanta. And Lisa, some of the people there immediately connected the shooting to a rise in violence against Asian Americans, something we know is happening across the country. Police, though, have not made that connection. What do we know about the motives of the shooter?
That's right. Well, they specifically, investigators asked the suspect whether or not it was a racially motivated targeting. And he himself, you know, he confessed to doing it, but says that that wasn't his motive. What he does say is he has a self-diagnosed sex addiction. Those are his words. And he said that he was apparently trying to eliminate forms of temptation that were bothering him. That's what we've heard so far.
Had he been a customer, do we know, at these spas?
We do not know that.
Any other suspects right now?
Not at the moment.
And in terms of how police apprehended him to begin with, I understand that his family helped track him down.
That's right. There was security footage of him in the first location up in Cherokee County, and that was released. And apparently, as soon as they saw it, his parents called in to authorities and began helping track him down.
One person we know, Lisa, survived the attacks. What is that person's condition?
Stable condition at the moment.
Do we know anything about that person?
We do not.
And how about those who didn't survive? What do we know about them?
You know, we don't know a great deal right now. It's still incredibly early. We know their names, many of which are Asian. We know two of the victims were white. We know that the victims in Cherokee County ranged in age from 33 to 50 years old, or 54 years old. But we don't know if they were customers working there and anything like that.
Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms addressed the backdrop of rising hate crimes against Asian Americans. Let's hear what she said.
Obviously, whatever the motivation was for this guy, we know that many of the victims, the majority of the victims, were Asian. We also know that this is an issue that's happening across the country. It is unacceptable. It is hateful, and it has to stop.
So, Lisa, how are Atlanta authorities responding to the attacks, given that kind of context?
You know, Mayor Bottom said that certainly her office and law enforcement was going to be open to coordinating with local Asian American communities and businesses, but it didn't seem like there were any plans in place to do that. Police do believe that they've stopped this from continuing. I think it's important to note that the mayor said that there has not been, unlike the rest of the country in many major cities, there hasn't been a reported uptick here of violence toward Asian Americans, and that's to police. But of course, not everyone reports crimes to the police, and I've seen some documentation of discrimination, at least 32 cases of discrimination last year against the Asian American community in Georgia.
And how about Atlantans you've spoken with? How are they reacting to the shootings?
I think there's a lot of anger right now. People are looking for folks to blame. There's been a lot of anger about the sort of tone of police officers thus far. One of the sheriff's office authorities said that the man was having a bad day yesterday. And I think he's been taken a bit out of context. He said it with as much incredulousness as was appropriate. But there's a tremendous amount of anger right now toward authorities of all kinds and feeling like the complaints about the fact that this was a hate motivated crime or not being taken seriously enough, that police are focusing too much on some of the other motivations they believe are involved.
All right. Thank you very much. Lisa Hagen, reporter for WABE in Atlanta. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Workers at an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, have 2 more weeks to decide whether they want to join a union. A successful union drive would be a first for the company, and supporters hope it would kick off a broader revival in labor organizing across the country. Let's get an update from Josh Idelson, labor reporter for Bloomberg. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
The union these Amazon employees are thinking about joining, the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, says that Amazon has been trying to dissuade them from organizing, surveilling them, and that Amazon has a history of this sort of thing, which is illegal, by the way. What is the latest on the union drive in Alabama as it comes down to the wire now on this vote?
Well, nobody knows exactly what's going to happen in Bessemer, including the people working or organizing or anti-union consulting in the warehouse. And workers have said Amazon is using a slew of the anti-union tactics available to U.S. employers, like requiring workers to attend anti-union meetings, telling workers they could lose benefits if they unionize, having supervisors approach employees one-on-one about the union, and posting anti-union messages in the bathrooms. There's also an anti-union website with a cartoon corgi wearing headphones.
And what's Amazon saying about that? I mean, are they saying that's true or what?
Amazon says that it's following the law and that it is helping its employees understand the facts and consequences of unionization, and that it doesn't think the union represents the views of most of the people that work in the warehouse.
All right. Well, we will see, because this vote will happen by the end of the month. Now, you recently reported that Amazon has several different ways to thwart negotiations at its warehouse in Bessemer, including contesting the results when they come in or even closing the facility. Talk about that. What could Amazon do to stop this from happening?
One study in the United States showed a year after workers won unionization elections, in 52% of cases, they still didn't have a union contract. And there are many cases where after workers win an election, a company has shut down a facility. And cutting off business at a location can have long-term consequences in terms of a chilling effect elsewhere, regardless of what the legal outcome is.
Well, this effort to unionize is getting a lot of attention because, of course, it is Amazon, and also because it's happening in a pretty conservative state. But these workers also have some pretty powerful supporters. Last month, President Biden released a video statement endorsing the right of workers to join a union, and he specifically mentioned the Amazon case. Let's listen.
It's not up to me to decide whether anyone should join a union. But let me be even more clear. It's not up to an employer to decide that either. The choice to join a union is up to the workers, full stop.
Now, we know President Biden supports unions, but I understand that was a pretty unusual statement for a sitting president to make.
That's right. For a U.S. president to involve himself as directly as President Biden has is a very unusual thing. And the message that he's sending is interesting, in part because it echoes federal labor law itself, which sets forth that the government not only is supposed to allow or protect, but actually to promote collective bargaining.
Hmm. Another endorsement, and this one is pretty surprising, frankly, came from Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida. He's a co-sponsor of a national right to work law. But in an op-ed for USA Today, he wrote that when the conflict is between working Americans and a company whose leadership has decided to wage culture war against working class values, the choice is easy. I support the workers. So, wow, I mean, Rubio, a pretty unusual ally for labor. What's he saying exactly?
Well, even in his op-ed, Rubio makes clear he still opposes the sorts of pro-labor legal changes that unions want passed to make it easier for workers like those at Amazon to organize. And he offers pretty specific criteria for what makes him support this Amazon union campaign. He cites things like the treatment of conservative books on Amazon's website. But that said, it is rare to see a prominent Republican lawmaker taking a stand like this in favor of unionization at a specific gigantic non-union U.S. company that's resisting it.
So considering everything we've just been talking about, where does all this leave the U.S. labor movement? And could the attention on Alabama inspire union drives elsewhere?
Absolutely. And in fact, the union RWDSU says already it's been hearing from Amazon workers elsewhere. And we've seen in the coronavirus era how some workers who previously might have been too afraid of retaliation to step forward have decided that now it's worth it in this crisis moment.
Josh Idelson covers labor for Bloomberg. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
President Biden's message to migrants who want to join the flood of asylum seekers at the U.S. southern border, don't come over. Biden acknowledged the situation is getting worse. He compared it to surges, though, in the past 2 years when Donald Trump was president. Biden told ABC's George Stephanopoulos that it's not true that migrants are heading to the U.S. because they think he'll be more favorable to them than the last administration was. Here he is with Stephanopoulos.
The adults are being sent back, number one. That's number one. Now, number two, what do you do with an unaccompanied child that comes to the border? Do you repeat what Trump did? Do you repeat what Trump did? Take them from their mothers, move them away, hold them in cells, et cetera? We're not doing that.
Our political strategists are here to talk about that. Alice Stewart is a Republican. Bill Press is a Democrat. Welcome both to Here and Now.
Hi, Lisa. Great
Hi,
to be
Lisa.
Here.
Top of the afternoon.
Nice to have you again. Top of the afternoon to you. Many of those migrants at the border are children traveling alone. And on Sunday, the U.S. had more than 4,200 unaccompanied children in custody. Many of them had spent much more time in detention facilities than the 72 hours allowed by law. Alice, you first. How do you characterize what's happening at the border?
There's no other way to characterize it, Lisa, other than a crisis at the border. And as much as the president and the administration doesn't want to call it that, that's the reality. And look, when he campaigned against President Trump on reversing the Trump-era immigration policies, that is akin to ringing the dinner bell at the border. And people came. They came by droves. They came in the thousands. And now we have a backlog of immigrants at the border. And the numbers, as you said, are staggering. And to have almost as now over 4,200 children unaccompanied, that should not happen. And being held longer than the time they should be held, that's even more problematic.
So, Bill, the White House has been careful not to label the situation what Alice just did, and that is a crisis at the border. The president himself is telling migrants not to come over. So you're a strategist. You both are. Is that messaging getting through?
Well, first of all, I would agree that it is a crisis, but I certainly disagree that this is unique, that we should be surprised. I mean, look, our memory's not that bad. There was a surge at the border under George W. Bush, under Barack Obama, under Donald Trump, the caravans, now under Joe Biden. Every new administration is tested at the border. This is just the latest. I have to tell you, Lisa, I'm from California. I take a long view on this. It didn't start with Biden. It didn't start with Trump. We've been at this for over 40 or 50 years. And the only answer is not to call them all rapists or criminals. It's not to pull a photo stunt at the border like Kevin McCarthy did this week. It's got to be Republicans and Democrats sitting down for a comprehensive immigration reform bill that will provide border security, a good process to stop illegal immigration, a good process for dealing with immigrants and those who seek refuge, and also a path to citizenship like Ronald Reagan provided for those who've been here for many years and contributing to our country. So, you know, the best plan I ever saw was George W. Bush's plan. It was shot down in the Senate. Barack Obama had a similar plan, shot down in the Senate. We haven't seen Joe Biden's plan yet, but I would just hope that the leaders of Congress will put a bipartisan group together, lock the door and say, you ain't coming out of here until you have a plan to deal with this crisis.
Lisa, if I may just follow up on that sure. I think it's foolhardy for this administration not to have anticipated what we have now. And for them to say at this point, do not come, well, it's too late. They are already here. And the only proposal that the administration now is supporting is a partisan comprehensive measure which will not pass. What we need is incremental immigration reform, starting with what is popular with the American people, which is protections for Dreamers. There is a bipartisan piece of legislation on the table, the Durbin Graham measure, that is addressing DACA and Dreamers, and that can and should be passed. That is up for a vote this week. But most critical is to address the situation, the crisis at the border, and then look at incremental change and not comprehensive.
Dreamers must be done, absolutely must be done, independently of everything else. But let's see if Republicans come to the table and are willing to deal on a comprehensive immigration reform. Talk is one thing, but if they deal with this like they did on the stimulus package, shame on them.
So I just want to confirm here that the House Democrats are indeed working on legislation right now that would create a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers, who are the immigrants who are brought to the U.S. illegally as children. I wonder, with the talk that's going on now, the labeling that's going on now, including by Representative McCarthy, Bill, you mentioned him. He was at the border, the House Minority Leader was, and he labeled this a Biden border crisis. We did not hear him talking about a Trump border crisis when there were and, as you said, the caravan happening at the border under Donald Trump's administration. To what extent, though, and Alice, you can take this, to what extent do you think this issue could rise to the level of becoming more significant than the Biden administration wants it to be? It's a significant issue, but with the labeling, how does that color it?
Well, look, Lisa, I'm really not, you know, in favor of labeling it one way or the other, but it is a crisis, but it is growing. You just look at the numbers. The numbers alone speak for themselves. When we have a 173% increase of migrants crossing the border from this time, February of 2020 to February of 2021, that is astounding. And the numbers do not lie. So the key is, how do we go about encouraging these migrants to stay in their countries and not come to the border, but finding a way, getting the resources at the border to handle certainly the unaccompanied minors that are here, but the people that are here trying to get into this country.
Okay, Bill, I want to talk about the relief bill that Biden has signed, and he kicked off his Help Is Here tour, touting the bill with a stop at a black-owned small business in Chester, Pennsylvania. Vice President Kamala Harris, the First Lady, the First Gentleman are all scheduled to make appearances on this tour. What is the goal?
The goal is to let people know that help is here. It is here in a very visible, very tangible way on many fronts. I mean, you know, we've talked about the last time about what's in this bill. You know, your family making not more than $150,000 a year, you've got a $1,400 check, an individual, up to $80,000 a year. You have a $1,400 check probably already in the bank. You're a mom with kids, you get $300 a month for each kid. Cut the child poverty level in half. Money there for states to open up new vaccine centers, money for small businesses and restaurants to stay alive. You just talked there on the news about money to reopen schools. Help is here. And I think that this will be the signature issue in 2022 in the midterms, Lisa, because the people who got these checks, and that's 95% of American families, they know two things about it. One, they got the help that they need. Two, not one single Republican, not one in the House, not one in the Senate voted for it. So the answer in 2022, did you vote for this bill, yes or no?
Alice, President Biden wants a tax increase for Americans making more than $400,000. This would be in the next phase of his economic plan. Given that he's unlikely to get Republicans on board with higher taxes, what could he potentially gain at all?
Well, he can do this in a partisan manner, like he's done many of the other things. And there's nothing to gain from that other than robbing Peter to pay Paul, because we have to find a way to pay for all of these expenses that he's done. And here's the problem with that, Lisa, is that when we have a economic crisis or situation that we have now, the last thing we need to be doing is taxing corporate businesses. We don't need to be putting taxes on the wealthy. We don't need to increase the estate tax, income tax on higher income wage earners. That is the last thing we need to be doing. It is not about increasing our taxes. It is about decreasing our expenses. And that's where we need to put the focus on. And penalizing the wealthy and the job creators of this country is the last thing we need to be doing.
Okay, I have one more issue.
Sure. Okay. I just very quickly, no crocodile tears for the millionaires and the billionaires. They got a huge cut under Obama. They got a huge cut under Bush. They got a huge cut under Trump. Give the tax breaks to the middle class people for once, and the wealthy will be fine.
Final issue, and this one we're going to have to just spend too little time on, but Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson is facing a backlash this week after his comments about the January 6th insurrection, which many people are calling racist. You might have heard this by now, but for our listeners who haven't, here's Senator Johnson.
I knew those are people that love this country, that truly respect law enforcement, would never do anything to break a law, and so I wasn't concerned. Now, had the tables been turned, Joe, this could be in trouble. Had the tables been turned and President Trump won the election, and those were tens of thousands of Black Lives Matter and Antifa protesters, I might have been a little concerned.
I wonder, Alice, first, and this has to be very brief by both of you, your reaction?
Those were stupid comments, and the people that involved in the insurrection didn't have any respect for law enforcement and certainly for members of Congress, and he should apologize for making such ludicrous comments.
Bill Press?
Quickly, outright, yep. Racist comments, shocking. What shocked me more was that not one single Republican senator, to my knowledge, has condemned those remarks. Not one. Why?
Bill Press is a Democratic political strategist. Alice Stewart, Republican political strategist. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you,
hey,
Lisa.
Thanks, Lisa.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Hearing loss is a fact of life for many humans, but not for fish, reptiles, or birds.
People noticed in chickens that they could take them to, say, a heavy metal concert, blast the ears really to oblivion, and then within days, new hair cells would begin to sprout.
The science of sound. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
When Deb Haaland was confirmed this week as Secretary of the Interior, she became the first Native American to hold that job. And it's one with a major impact on the lives of indigenous people and tribal lands. Joining us now is Len Nesifer. He's an assistant professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He wrote about his support for Secretary Haaland this week in Outside Magazine. Len, thanks for being here.
Yeah, excited to be here.
Yeah, and you write in the magazine that the confirmation of Haaland marks a groundbreaking moment for you personally as a Navajo man. Can you tell me why?
You know, so much of my identity as a Navajo person is both a racial one and a legal and political one. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, which sits under the Department of Interior in many ways, has basically been the conduit in which treaty obligations and the relationship with the federal government has been managed between myself and the tribe and the tribe and the federal government.
Well, you also say that as a Navajo man, the Department of Interior has defined much of your own life, especially when it comes to things like healthcare and education. Can you explain how and describe, you know, how Secretary Haaland will shape other people's lives in those areas?
The Department of Interior in many ways has been the ways in which I've received things like healthcare and education that were promised in treaties that were signed between my tribe in 1868 and the federal government. That's meant the kind of education I get, the sorts of funding that the Indian Health Care Service receives. You know, in many ways, that's been underfunded for quite a long time and not given priority. So I've seen that firsthand, but my hope is that it will be different.
What do you think Secretary Haaland could do on those issues to make it different?
I think one of the things that we're probably going to see is a more robust tribal consultation process. So just simply having conversations with tribes at the beginning of policy discussions. Normally, tribes are consulted, have been consulted right at the end, sort of as a box checking measure.
One of the big issues that she'll have to face is climate policy, of course, energy policy as well. Many tribes, as you know, have a complicated relationship with fossil fuel extraction and mining. It's not so black and white. Many of them rely on coal and gas and oil for jobs and to help their economy. Others say it desecrates the land. How do you think she's going to handle that?
Yeah, you know, there's a number of tribes in the United States that rely on oil and gas and coal extraction for their economic development. In some instances, it's because it's their only option. There's certain tribes like the Southern Ute Tribe who have managed their oil and gas resources incredibly well and have a higher bond rating than the U.S. government because of it. And I think in terms of trying to say one size fits all for Indian country, and really when we look at energy, that's clearly not the case. Tribes know what's best for themselves, and the policies of the past two centuries has largely rested on the idea that Native peoples are incapable of managing their own affairs, and I think we're going to see a big shift away from that.
So does that mean that Secretary Holland won't necessarily support policies that dash extractive industries?
I think there will be very vigorous and deliberate conversations with tribes early on. You know, at the end of the day, she is implementing President Biden's energy policy, which has part of that commitment is the 30 by 30, reducing emissions from public lands. And, you know, I think there's going to be a robust discussion around that and what that looks like. I also think that looking at in what ways can the federal government provide tribes with alternatives to extractive resource development is something that's probably going to be on the table as well.
Len Nesifer is an assistant professor of American Indian Studies and Public Policy at the University of Arizona in Tucson and a member of the Navajo Nation. Len, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This week marks 10 years since the civil war in Syria began. A peaceful protest spiraled into a conflict that has involved world powers, including the U.S. and Russia, and it's claimed hundreds of thousands of lives and triggered what the U.N. Refugee Agency calls the world's largest refugee crisis. CNN senior international correspondent Arwa Damon has gone to Syria to follow the war and its impact on Syrians many times in the last decade. She joined us today from Istanbul, Turkey, on Skype to talk about her reporting. And we have this warning, we'll be hearing some graphic descriptions of violence. She told us what she found on a recent trip to Idlib, Syria, and how it compared to other trips she's made.
Well, on this trip back, a ceasefire had been in place, basically for about a year, that held and has been holding for a lot longer than any of those in the past. And so what we were able to see is what happens to a population when they are given that level of breathing room. That being said, you still have well over 1.5 million people living inside these refugee camps who have been struggling because of border shutdowns and financial aid drying up because of COVID-19. And looking at many of them as we were driving through Idlib and looking out at the children, especially the younger ones, what one is really struck by is how they don't know what it's like to sleep inside a warm bed. They sleep in tents on thin, threadbare mattresses. The space outside of the tent is dirty, dusty, or turns into thick mud whenever it rains. It gets bitterly cold at night. Showers aren't showers. It's, you know, a trickle of water, a bucket poured over your head. A hot meal is cooked, you know, either outside on a burning fire or inside in what can be quite dangerous at times, you know, small little kerosene canisters. I met a 13-year-old girl, so she would have been 3 when the war started. She had lost her father early on. He was detained by regime forces, she said. And then a few years later, her left leg was blown off by a mine. And I asked her, do you dream of a world without war? She said, no. I said, why? She was completely silent. And then I asked her, can you dream of a life without war? And she said, no. And that's just so striking. This girl cannot dream of a life without war because she does not know what that looks like.
And one of the things in that report that comes out is that the reason that she lost part of her leg is that their home, the family home, the outside gate had been laced with mines, and they didn't even know that. I mean, this is how close they are to the conflict.
Exactly. And so this family had actually fled from their home because the area where their home was, you know, a front line. It would go back and forth between rebel control, regime control. And so their house had actually been destroyed in an airstrike. And she had gone back with some of her cousins and other siblings with her grandfather to try to see what they could salvage from the rubble. And so they did not know that the outside wall of their home and the gate itself had been daisy chained with mines. And she was playing hide and seek. And then she went and she was swinging on the gate, you know, kind of holding on to it and just rocking back and forth. And that's when the mine went off.
There's a little boy that you met, Sultan, who's 10 years old as the war itself. And as you say, he too represents a generation of children who've known little but trauma. He at least was able to leave. Unfortunately, it's because of really severe burns that he had suffered. You spoke with him and with his mom in their apartment in Turkey, where he is right now. Let's hear a little bit of your narration from that report.
Sultan was playing on his bike when a rocket blew up fuel canisters nearby. An ambulance brought Sultan to Turkey. He and his mother have been there ever since.
I wonder how he's getting through. How is he doing?
What we were really taken back by when we met him, because, you know, all that we really initially knew was that we were going in to meet this little boy who was 10 years old, who'd suffered horrific tragedies, who had been wounded. So the expectation was, because we've met so many other children in similar situations, was that he would be similar to them. And by that, I mean, you see the innocence of childlike joy deadened. They're often very sullen and angry. And so when we walk into this apartment and we meet him and he breaks out into this smile that just captures your heart, his eyes are sparkling. He's playing with Play-Doh and making us little hearts out of it. He's talking about how he wants to be an architect because he wants to build his mother a beautiful home, the home of her dreams. But then you do see the darkness coming in. You do see his face physically change as he remembers the past because of everything that he's been through. So on the one hand, you could say this child is better adjusted than others perhaps who are still inside Syria. But that's not to say that he does not need a lot of help moving forward in terms of how to navigate this, because his mother doesn't know how to help him mentally process everything. She's still trying to process it herself. He needs professional help.
And when you're talking about them needing mental health help, the mother, when you talk about what she has endured, tell us who she's lost in the family and how.
So when Sultan was 5 years old, his baby brother was killed in an airstrike. And his mother, Omar, had put the baby down underneath a window. Airstrike comes in, glass shatters, wall breaks. She screams, goes running in. And as she's talking about this, she just has tears pouring down her face. The neighbors come in and they pull out her baby's body. And then she motions across her neck to show us that her baby's neck had been slit. A year later, her husband says he's going out to the market. He's going to buy vegetables. There's an airstrike on the market. Her husband is killed. 2 years later, so now Sultan is 8. That's when the strike that results in Sultan being horrifically burned happens. And she talks about how she saw him screaming in flames and she didn't know what to do. She didn't know how to put out the flames. What was she supposed to do? Was she supposed to try to fill a bucket with water, find a blanket? She gestures showing us how she begins, you know, trying to use her hands to put out the flames. She's screaming for help. And then she says, I eventually managed to put out the fire, but it was too late. And then what she also remembers is the other children in the town where they live, which was also on a front line, which sustained very heavy bombing, how they saw so many children die, how they tried to save them, and they weren't even able to save a single one. And you can just tell that her pain is so deep. It's gutting her completely and utterly. The only reason why she's holding it together is because of Sultan.
So looking back at the 10 years, you wrote something that I'd like to read a little bit from right now. You wrote, "Long gone is the illusion that any reporting out of Syria will change the realities on the ground. That was painfully eliminated early on. It ripped many of us journalists to shreds, left us flailing, wondering what more we could have done or what we should have done better. It gutted us to hear from contacts and activists who became friends over the years repeatedly ask, 'Why doesn't anyone care?'" Do you feel as if your reporting, telling stories like the ones you've just told us, has made a difference?
Not in the grand scheme of things, and that's been something that's been quite difficult for myself and I think for anyone else covering what was happening in Syria to reconcile. Because if it had made a difference, Syria wouldn't be where it was today. Reporting from Syria is not about giving a voice to the voiceless. It's become about trying to figure out how to get people to listen. And what Syria has taught us is that it doesn't matter how many bodies are pulled out from underneath the rubble. It doesn't matter how many people are killed or displaced or disappeared. It doesn't matter because there were bigger geopolitical games at play. And it's quite tragic when you think that, you know, years ago people used to ask us, "Why doesn't anyone care?" And you know, when you go back to Syria right now, they don't even ask that question anymore.
Well, we appreciate all your reporting, and I wish you strength as you continue. CNN senior international correspondent Arwa Damon, covering 10 years of civil war in Syria. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The youngest person charged so far in connection with the storming of the U.S. Capitol has been released on bail this week. He's accused of breaching the Capitol, shoving a police officer, and posting violent messages on social media. The young man's political radicalization echoes that of another kind of extremism from the not-so-distant past. NPR investigative correspondent Dina Temple-Raston has more in this report that first aired on Morning Edition.
18-year-old Bruno Kua traveled to Washington, D.C. from Georgia on January 5th. His father was a great supporter of the former presidents. So was his mother. So they decided to attend the Trump rally together as a family. But the younger Kua was more passionate than his parents about Trump and the election. According to court documents, in December, one of his posts on social media allegedly read, "I don't want to sit here in Georgia and watch. I want to fight." As he saw it, the 2020 election had been stolen, and he had to do something about it. The day of the Trump rally, the Kuas followed the crowd to the Capitol. They watched as a scuffle broke out on the stairs, and Bruno asked his parents if he could get a closer look. Bruno Kua, it turns out, went much further than the Capitol steps. He went inside the building, and according to the government, when he ran into police outside the Senate chamber, he shoved them out of the way to get inside. Video footage places him there, just as one of the rioters was telling a handful of others they shouldn't be sitting in Vice President Mike Pence's chair. Bruno Kua responded like a typical 18-year-old.
"They can steal an election, we can't sit in their chair?"
"No!"
If they can steal an election, he says, why can't we sit in their chairs? Prosecutors say Kua is a violent, true believer. They say he assaulted police and was carrying a collapsible baton as a weapon. His social media posts in the run-up to the insurrection suggest that he was angry and primed for action. Kua's defense attorneys see it a little differently. They say their client was being fed a steady diet of far-right content and conspiracy theories, and he was duped into believing things that weren't true, which, people who have studied radicalization say, sounds a lot like what happened almost 10 years ago, when another group of young people were radicalized in much the same way. But in that case, their focus was on ISIS.
"I thought they were courageous, and I thought they were standing up for what they believed in, you know."
That's a young man named Abdullahi Yusuf. Back in 2014, when he was 18, he began following the Syrian civil war. It eventually led him to join ISIS with a bunch of his friends in Minneapolis. I spoke to him a few years later for a podcast called What Were You Thinking? And I asked him why it happened.
"I think you'd have a hard time talking me out of what I believed in at the time. we're the ones doing something noble.
Yusuf and his friends watched the ISIS videos over and over again.
I was mesmerized, you know, like I didn't even know they existed.
And he came to the conclusion that he couldn't just sit on the sidelines while women and children were dying in Syria. He came to believe that he was just like those fighters in those videos he kept watching.
You know, it's just check, 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 check. That's me, that's me, that's me, that's me. And, you know, sign me up.
And he would have made it to Syria if the FBI hadn't stopped him at the airport. Radicalization happens that fast. And while Abdullahi Yusuf and Bruno Kua might have been driven by very different ideologies, the process by which they became extremists was remarkably similar. For both of them, what they consumed online warped and narrowed their vision of the world. A stolen election had to be overturned in one case, and innocent Syrians had to be saved in the other.
One of the interesting things about the current misinformation landscape is it's not necessarily uninformed people, it's misinformed people.
Sam Jackson is an assistant professor at University at Albany.
It's people who say, I do my own research. I don't trust the elites. And their research is nonsense. It's sophisticated nonsense.
Jackson studies extremist groups and the way they use online propaganda to nibble away at a recruit's worldview. In Kua's case, the person who inspired him was the former president.
We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
For many people on January 6th, the storming of the Capitol was about standing up for something. It was about a love of country, Jackson again.
This rhetoric about patriotism is causing me to realize more parallels with these folks and some of the jihadis who understand the world in this very strict good versus evil kind of way.
And when the world is black and white or right versus wrong, finding facts to fit that narrative is vital. Alexandra Mena-Stern, a professor of American culture and politics at University of Michigan, says people find what they need online.
We in many ways are living in this post-truth era where whether it's a lie or truth doesn't matter to many people. What matters is that whatever the alternative facts are, so-called, actually resonate and make sense to them.
Abdullahi Yusuf said that it took a while to understand how ISIS had duped him.
It's only sad stories, you know. It's not, you don't hear any. I guarantee you everyone who went there regrets it.
Bruno Kua spent more than a month in jail. His lawyers say he was assaulted there, and he has tested positive for COVID-19. A judge decided last week that Kua can be released to his parents, pending trial. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.